Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with part two of our special episode on infectious disease in the wilderness and austere medical setting. And we are really excited to bring back Dr. Seth Hawkins and the chapter author from the Wilderness EMS textbook, Dr. Chris Davis. So he's no relation to me, but definitely a very knowledgeable individual, way more knowledgeable than I am. And we bring him back and we talk a little bit more about the different diagnostic opportunities and tools and methods that can be used to identify infectious diseases and how to manage them in the wilderness setting. So let's get on into that second half of that episode. If you haven't caught the first part of the episode, go ahead and check back on last week's episode at disasterpodcast.com or in your podcast device or application. You can go ahead and check out how to get last week's episode there, but definitely listen to that because it's just an action-packed, full of information episode, and you'll want to make sure you don't miss any of it. So without further ado, let's jump on into this segment with Dr. Seth Hawkins, Dr. Chris Davis, Dr. Joe Holly, Kyle Nelson, Sam Bradley, and myself as we talk about infectious disease in the wilderness setting.
For a fair number of our listeners who are docs and medics and others that respond to disaster, all over the world. Could you guys sort of try to boil things down to its purest essence? And really where I'm trying to go with this question is the simple question of, so I've got a guy in the wilderness environment that's a rescuer that's been there for several days and has had lots of water exposure and all the other stuff that we always get when we're out there. And at what point do you decide I probably should start this guy on antibiotics? And the core question I'm really trying to get to is, do you look for signs of systemic response to an inflammatory condition? And is that sort of say, all right, if you're starting to see those things, it's time to go ahead and initiate some antibiotics? Or should you hold back a little bit and let things play out a little bit longer?
Well, I'd be interested to hear kind of Seth's take on this too, because I don't know if we may not necessarily have the same opinion on this, but I definitely am a little more of the mind to kind of take it a little bit slower, knowing that there are a lot of other things that could be causing symptoms. And for me, I really looked for the signs of systemic illness, exactly what you're saying there. That, I mean, it's once by the time someone's getting a fever, if they're starting to feel ill overall, from whatever infection it is that they look like they're having, or I guess I boil it down to two things. If they look like they're systemically ill, or if I look like the trajectory of this thing is not going in a great direction. So if this little infection on their leg is doubled in size, or things starting to look bigger or worse, and it doesn't seem like we're going in the right direction, I have a pretty low threshold to kind of pull the trigger and start someone on some antibiotics.
Seth?
Yeah, I think I'm right there the same. And I might configure it in a slightly different way of environment and resources. So partly the decision we're making depends on the environment that we're in. So for instance, we know that the military will deploy antibiotics to anybody with an open traumatic wound, which is a different situation, but still a prophylactic infectious disease prevention modality. And so for traumatic wounds that have maybe open fractures or things where you might predictably anticipate there could be critically dangerous infections, they start deploying antibiotics right away without any signs or symptoms indicating infection whatsoever. So there's a little bit of that environmental feature. I think for us, it would be similar to that kind of consequential question about the environment. Like, is this something where the danger of having an infection develop would be so great because you're so far out and it would be so difficult to manage an infection should it come that there's actually a benefit to even prophylactic use of antibiotics or for early treatment of things that you're concerned might develop into a dangerous condition? But the other factor to that is resources. And that's the other thing that we really have to bear in mind in any wilderness or disaster austere environment. Although I have to say, to give a shout out to Alexander Godfrey, one of the PAs I work with at my emergency department, she walked up to me last night and said, I think we're starting to practice wilderness medicine in our emergency department because we have so many shortages of critical medications, which I know everybody who's a healthcare provider in the audience will appreciate. So there is that element where now we have to be careful about good stewardship of the rare drugs that we can actually use now in a hospital. But more typically, like on an expedition, you may have 10 doses of an antibiotic. So you're going to need to decide what the threshold is for using those based on the fact that there's no chance of replenishment. And that's sort of commonsensical, but until we bring it up, it's not something that one might think about. But that decision of the threshold of, like, you know, you're on a rafting trip and you have somebody who's been in the water and you're looking for those indications that say that antibiotics need to be used. Just like Chris said, you might have a higher threshold because you don't have as much antibiotics as you don't have an infinite supply of them. So you want to be sure you're using them wisely. You might have a lower threshold if your antibiotic resources seem to be pretty strong or there's chances for replenishment, but the risk of the infection would be really critical.
Joe.
So, Seth, I think that's an excellent thought algorithm, and I agree with everything you said, but I'm not going to tell anybody that I did. But, you're dead on target with having to weigh the austerity of the situation, supplies, et cetera, with the need to push forward on treatment of that patient, knowing that if you use all your antibiotics on that guy, the next guy that has an issue is not going to have anything. So to me, it says a huge amount about the need for very educated and well-trained physicians and medics and others, medical providers in austere conditions, whether that's related to disaster stuff or wilderness medicine, et cetera. This is an area, I think, where we have an awful lot of common ground between all of those different areas of austere medicine and one where the decision-making becomes very challenging and really requires a significant depth of thought to do the right thing at the right time and do the best for our patients.
Seth. Tag on that?
Yeah, I think just talking about thresholds, one parameter I wanted to throw into what Chris was discussing earlier about pulmonary infections, and I hadn't had a chance to jump in, and this is really a good exemplification of the complexities of wilderness medicine, is that we need to have a whole different category for what he was describing for those high-altitude operations where we're dealing with pulmonary infections. And this is a great example of how you can talk about one environment and it not necessarily apply to all. So I think, Chris would agree that at altitude, should you be on a mountaineering trip, the shortness of breath, the low oxygen levels can all be signs of altitude reaction. It could be the onset of pulmonary edema. So again, talking about environment, you know, it's very important to remember the context at which things are being described and the other non-infectious masqueraders that we could be dealing with. And I think ultimately what that says to me, to mirror exactly what we were just saying, is that there's a perception that there's healthcare and then there's wilderness medicine, and healthcare is complicated and practiced in a hospital, and wilderness medicine is very much sort of first aid and pretty simple and involves just the application of algorithms. And that couldn't be further from the truth. I think both Chris's and my experience, at least, is that delivering healthcare in a wilderness setting, because of all these things we're describing, is that much more difficult. And all those sort of fine points that you're talking about in terms of deciding how to use limited resources or thresholds that may be different than they were in a traditional setting is all of what really points to the fact that we need to have potentially an even more complex healthcare training process for people who are practicing medicine either at the BLS or ALS or clinician level in the wilderness than we might for the front country, because in a lot of ways it's really trickier. I mean, for crying out loud, this guy here has taken 2 years of his life to get a fellowship in wilderness EMS, so it's got to be complicated.
Hopefully that's not just a more of a comment on my speed of learning things, but so
I think you've done more than most of us have in your life. So I know that that's definitely not true.
Well, here's a question we were sort of talking about offline, and I'd like to hear from all of you. What is the best type of antibiotic to have when you're dealing with all of these different potential issues out there? And obviously, you can't carry a whole pharmacy. So, Chris, what's your take on that?
Yeah, this is a great question. I mean, we have had countless conversations offline and online with Seth and other authors from the textbook about what is that antibiotic that you're going to bring if you can only bring one or you can only bring two. And so it really boils down to a few things. So we have to consider, what kind of bugs are we going to encounter? Okay, what are the common infections we're going to try to treat? We also have to consider, how are we going to be able to administer that antibiotic? I mean, do we have to start an IV or something on someone to give them an IV antibiotic? That presents its whole own set of challenges. And, you know, needles in the backcountry are not always a good thing. And if you've got to have to move people around, have them in a litter, have IV bags hanging and things, that's certainly not optimal. So that definitely would make me think, oh, my gosh, we should definitely try to go with oral antibiotics. And that's all great. They're easy to store. They're temperature stable. That's all great. But then sometimes people are sick and they have nausea and they can't tolerate stuff by mouth. So that would lean you then back towards some antibiotics that are injectable. So, you know, when we try to look for stuff that, you know, stuff I would really want to have. And one of the antibiotics that I think really covers the best variety of different pathogens, different bacteria that are dangerous, things that are going to either kill you or really maim you, things that you're likely to get, we settled on ceftriaxone or Rocephin is the antibiotic that I keep with me in my kit, because it can honestly treat everything from meningitis to urinary tract infections to skin and soft tissue infections, open fractures. It really is a great medicine from that standpoint. It comes as powdered that has to be reconstituted and can be given both intramuscularly and intravenously. So I can give that patient a shot in their arm, essentially, and it has the same efficacy as if it's given intravenously. So that's a great antibiotic. It definitely treats pneumonia. It treats a lot of different stuff, and it also has the benefit of being inexpensive, which is a great tool of attribute as well. You know, there's plenty of other things that we considered as well. You know, if we're going to take one oral antibiotic, I mean, one of the best that you could possibly take would be doxycycline. That will cover a lot of the infections that you would be concerned about related to the wilderness. All of our tick-borne diseases and things are covered by doxycycline, but it also does well against staph and strep, which are common causes of skin and soft tissue infections, and also does great with pulmonary infections and as well as GU infections as well. So it's a pretty good antibiotic. So if you're going to have two, those are pretty good too. You know, if money's no object, I don't know, Joe, if you guys in the USAR community have imipenem, I know is used pretty commonly in some of the special operations environments and things for similar reasons to ceftriaxone, but it's definitely more expensive and you get a little bit of extra coverage for some other more uncommon bugs out of that. But, you know, if money were no option, imipenem would be a great option, but you know, ceftriaxone is the one that I've really settled on as being the sort of, if I had a single do everything antibiotic, that's the one. And then doxycycline for an oral antibiotic.
Joe, what do you think about that?
Oh, I actually agree with that. You know, the only other thing that we tend to add on very often is a floxacin of some sort. And I can sort of see those beginning to lose some support with, you know, all the other issues that are going on with the floxins now. So,
yeah, we discussed that quite a bit, and that, you know, the Infectious Disease Society of America has recently kind of pulled ciprofloxacin back for first line treatment for pyelonephritis, and we're seeing lots of resistance to it, and we've definitely seen a lot of new concerns coming out with tendon rupture and, you know, black box warning now with the floxacin. So it's been a pretty staple antibiotic for a long time, but, you know, we're definitely starting to look elsewhere kind of in all of our practice, I think.
Seth, your thoughts?
Yeah, and what this is writing everyone into is the evolution of medical care as resistance forms from organisms, and some more side effects are recognized. And really, I think we've discussed this before, but what this really portrays is the importance of applying medical science to disaster and wilderness responses. There's a tendency to think that, you know, you learn something in 1980, and so you just have to kind of keep reserting a card, and things don't change. And medicine changes so much, partly because the world changes, and partly because the application of science leads us to understand things better. So in some ways, we understand the antibiotics we're using better, but in other ways, things that worked fantastically 5 or 10 years ago are now almost useless. So I think it's important briefly to speak to antibiotic stewardship and the importance of retaining antibiotics for, you know, critical uses or necessary uses, and also just to appeal to everyone that medical training needs to be kept up because medicine changes, bugs change, and our practice environment changes.
Chris, is it common or uncommon to run into any kind of CNS infection, meningitis, that kind of thing?
Oh gosh, it's definitely, I'd say, uncommon. I've certainly never run across that, and you know, the only real CNS sort of related infection I've really heard about much here is there's a great case report from Wilderness Environmental Medicine Journal a few years ago about multiple people being exposed to rabies while on a river trip in the Grand Canyon. And boy, this is something, if you want to read an interesting medical tale, to look up and read this case report. It really involved a pretty epic story of trying to evacuate people out to try to get some prophylaxis, some rabies shots, and rabies immunoglobulin, basically to fight this rabies infection. It's pretty harrowing. But I guess that, and then I guess we're also recently kind of very close home to me, certainly wasn't a wilderness infection, but the, you know, you may have heard, was it last summer or 2 summers ago, about the sort of the brain eating amoebas, the Glaria fowleri, that was right near me in the Charlotte Whitewater Center. That's a really unfortunate parasitic infection where amoebas kind of get forced up your nose and make their way through part of your skull called the cribriform plate. And it's like a cribbage board, and all of your olfactory nerves kind of come directly from your brain to your nose. And the amoebas can go up, get into your brain through your nose. And unfortunately, there's really no treatment for that. So really, CNS infections are always pretty devastating. And sort of the wilderness associated ones, you know, other than, you know, rabies being a pretty bad one, and Naegleria also, you know, there'll be a few cases every year, but we, you know, we had one recently at the right around here in Charlotte that gained a lot of attention in the media.
Seth, you have 3 exclamation points, so it must be important.
Well, it's something that's come up often in social media and some mainstream media about the prevalence of ticks and tick-borne illnesses, and some climate change explanations for potentially why we're seeing many more ticks and the diseases that they may spread. But important to recognize that we're seeing more of these, like encephalitis conditions, which are difficult to diagnose. They are later than a trip oftentimes. And I think it brings up a really important infectious disease point that antibiotics, we talk a lot about antibiotics because we're worried a lot about bacteria. Many of these disease processes are easier to prevent than to treat. And so discussing isolating out ticks and mosquitoes exposures from like disaster deployments or from recreational trips is really important for the prevention of infectious disease. So, you know, Zika has been in the news and a bunch of these animal vectors and insect vector diseases that when contracted are very hard to treat and can be devastating. So just a brief shout out to reviewing techniques for reducing mosquito bites and tick bites during activities.
Back to you, Chris.
Yeah, that's a really nice segue, Seth, into kind of another, I think, really relevant point, particularly when we're considering both the flooding and this is, you know, a real disaster audience, that one of the biggest thing of vector-borne illnesses, a lot of those can have some CNS involvement and symptoms, things like, you know, Japanese encephalitis and West Nile virus. A lot of these other things are not bacteria that we're going to see commonly through these sort of mosquito-borne diseases. But like Seth said, I mean, can't emphasize enough that we don't have good treatment for a lot of these, particularly the viral infections. So the key is really sort of the controlling the vector. So for y'all in the disaster world, I'm sure this is very relevant all the time, you know, about eliminating standing water, using barrier protection, having bed nets up if there's a lot of mosquitoes, and you know, wearing appropriate bug repellent. You know, as terrible as DEET is for your clothing and gear and things like that, it's still probably our most effective mosquito repellent. And then also, you know, making sure with ticks that we do in tick checks. And, you know, we've been getting a lot of, you know, definitely as I've probably found, I don't know, 4 or 5 ticks on my dog already this spring. It's been pretty big tick season. And so that stuff is pretty important, and really removing ticks, checking for ticks, trying to control, you know, the number of mosquito bites you're getting. That's all pretty important stuff. Which cannot be emphasized enough.
So I think Sam might have had to step out for a moment, so I'm going to go ahead and pick up here. So I think that this has been a great overview and kind of giving us a glimpse into some things that I don't think we think about quite that often. But now I'm kind of worried, you know, I mean, that these things are more prevalent than you might think. Is that true, Chris, or is it just that we've been talking about them for the last 45 minutes?
I think it's mostly just how much you've been talking about. I mean, this is definitely, you know, pales in comparison to the number of cases of broken ankles and, you know, falls off cliffs and things like that are definitely the more common wilderness incidents that we're going to see. But you know, being prepared to deal with infectious diseases in the wilderness environment is really important, particularly in the context of disaster response, where things are necessarily going to be a prolonged operation. So a little bit of preparation and some knowledge about how to recognize these things can definitely, hopefully, prevent stuff from going from a minor inconvenience and taking a Z-Pak to, you know, having an overwhelming infection.
I don't want amoebas up my nose. Thank you. That's very right. Much. I'm going to have nightmares, you guys. We could do an entire podcast just on weird things like that. But, you know, you kind of answered that question, actually. But, you know, Seth, if you were to give a point or two to responders to keep them safe out there, what are some of the main things? He mentioned mosquito nets and so forth, but what, anything else you can think of that you would pass on to them?
Yeah, a lot of this is scary, but it's also pretty amazing how resilient the human body is, and the fact that we have so many mechanisms in place to reduce infection. So it's pretty remarkable that we could be bathed in all these pathogens and all these things that can hurt us and don't get sick more often. So I think the good news is that our bodies are really extraordinary, and I think really enhancing those elements that we have to prevent infection is really the most important message. So I think wearing, you know, long clothes that prevent injuries like cuts as well as bites allows our skin to stay strong. So an active and healthy skin system is just an amazing structure for preventing infection. And then I think should we develop impairments in skin, like I remember deploying to Hurricane Floyd and wading through flood water for a couple days with some cuts on my skin. And so I would like cover them with Tegaderm, like these really occlusive, tight dressings, just things that can prevent those points where your skin is open to the environment. And then honestly, there's a small pitch here just for overall health. I think we all know that our susceptibility to illness is measured in part by our health. So, you know, ensuring that we have adequate diets on our trips, our disaster deployments, and getting enough sleep and doing those things to be sure that our bodies are strong. A strong body is much more able to fight off infection. This sounds really sort of like your mother, and it sounds like commonsensical, but oftentimes personal health is something that gets thrown to the side when you feel like you're doing something which is truly heroic, like responding to a disaster or to a wilderness emergency. But we all need to remember that that we will not be effective if we get sick ourselves on something. And I do think maybe we should throw out there to reopen the fear box that really one of the biggest disasters we've seen in modern history has been the influenza pandemic. So it's very true that we fixate on disasters like hurricanes and floods and tornadoes. In fact, you know, our next major disaster could be a pandemic influenza. It could be smallpox being released. So, you know, there's also the possibility that infectious diseases are not just confined to the wilderness, but become either a weaponized or an evolving viral strain that becomes threatening to our entire species. And that's the next big, you know, disaster challenge we face.
That's a whole nother podcast, Seth, that I think we need to do, because that's something we have to do. Chris, you had some final thoughts on taking care of yourself.
Yeah, just some final thoughts as Seth reopened the fear box about a worldwide pandemic influenza that's going to kill all of us. You know, that's definitely to bring it back a little bit more closer to home about, you know, I certainly agree with all of that, you know, that we need to take care of ourselves. And one of the things that is really, I think, one of the most common incapacitating things that make you feel terrible that you really do encounter frequently. And we've heard that, you know, Jamie mentioned this already earlier, is gastrointestinal illnesses. And boy, they can become not quite pandemic, but certainly epidemic within your group pretty quickly. So remembering to wash your hands, use good hygiene when preparing meals, and really pay attention to food storage conditions. These are all things that easy to overlook when you're in a disaster, when you're responding to a wilderness emergency. But boy, nothing can incapacitate a group or a rescuer faster than a really bad case of diarrhea and nausea and vomiting. So that is, I don't think I can emphasize that enough. Wash your hands, pay attention to how you're preparing your food, and that can prevent your own small scale disaster right there in your own group.
Well, and Joe and I could both appreciate that being on federal teams. We've both seen diarrhea run through the entire team. We don't know where it starts, but we know where it ends. Right, Joe?
Yes, that's exactly correct. I was just thinking exactly that. I remember spending an entire month on a 10-day-long deployment in Utah for the Olympics with 40% of my team spending most of the day in the bathroom and the fun we had around that. So agree completely.
Not fun. And thank you, Seth, for all the nightmares I'm going to have tonight about things crawling out my nose. But we've learned a lot from you guys. Oh, this has been insane. I really don't even want to stop. I know we have to. Chris, we have to get you back. There's just so much more we can talk about on this topic. One of those things being, yeah, if my dog is saying stop. One of those things is immunizations for responders. You know, there's just so much more we can do with this. So we'd love to have you back again.
I'd love to come back anytime.
Excellent. Jamie, I'm just going to throw it back to you and let you close us up here.
All right. Sounds good. You know, I think that one of the points that we keep coming back to and reason we actually do this show is because it's all about education and learning and, you know, using this excellent textbook and resource that Seth turned us on to, and bringing, he's responsible for bringing people like Chris and the other chapter authors in here to talk to our community. And I think that, you know, that's one of the things, Joe, that we've talked about again and again and again, is the resources are needed to train people, to educate people about the appropriate things they need to be prepared for. And this is something you guys at Paragon Medical Education Group do all the time. You get out there into communities and prepare disaster responders for the things they can expect, using people that have been there, that have been on that deployment where 40% of the team is down with a GI illness. And you know, how do you prepare for that? How do you prevent that? Because I think prevention is one of those things that goes a long way towards stopping things from happening.
Well, there's no question about that, and that is why we use extremely experienced providers and those with a lot of sort of street cred as part of our instructor cadre. As a matter of fact, the textbook that we've been discussing tonight and on the past several episodes is actually on my bedside table as I read it for future ideas and customizations to our disaster training that we offer to folks everywhere.
If folks want to bring you guys in and really have you actually get started on the process of just talking to you, and I think that's one of the things that I try to impress upon people, is that really to understand what you can bring to the table, is they really need to just reach out to you and say, hey, what can you do? What, these are our resources. These are our needs. What can you do for us? How can they reach out to you?
I think that makes the most sense. It is a very customizable experience, and we've actually been sort of overwhelmed with the number of emails in the last couple of weeks for folks seeking information. But if you just go to the website at ParagonMedicalEducationGroup.com, or you can find us at Paragon Medical Group on Facebook, and you can always reach out to us through the Disaster Podcast. We would absolutely love to talk to you and just help to explain what we do and can do for each and every situation.
Excellent. And Joe, thanks again for your continued support here of the Disaster Podcast. We really appreciate it. Chris, is there a way that folks can reach out to you? I don't know if you're active on any social media platforms or things like that. We have a Facebook group that people can join and have conversations in.
Absolutely. I can. I'm not nearly as social media connected as Seth is, and he's really impressive with his presence there. But I could be reached sort of personally by email at christa@wakehealth.edu. And also I will engage with folks on the Facebook group for sure. I definitely will hang around there and answer any questions people have.
Excellent. Fantastic. And Seth, where can folks find you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at HawkVox, HawkVox. I'm on Facebook. And in fact, the Wilderness EMS textbook now has a Facebook page as well, just under Wilderness EMS. So we'd be delighted to carry on this dialogue on any social media platform.
Excellent. I'll make sure I link to that in the show notes as well, and make sure folks know where to find that. And actually, you can go ahead and leave that link in the our Facebook group as well if you want to cross link it. We'd love to give that resource out there for people. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jimmy, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WXKyleNelson. So feel free to connect with me there and continue the conversation.
And Joe, you had a final comment you'd like to share with the group?
Well, I did. I just wanted to say thanks again to Seth and Chris and all the guys that we've had on the last few weeks with this textbook. I think it is a phenomenal resource that I would recommend to all of my fellow USTAR docs. It's small enough that you can carry it with you, and I think it's a phenomenal resource. So kudos to you guys for a great product, and thanks for being on the podcast.
It's always our pleasure. We love coming on.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Well, you know, Seth, keep your head down. It looks like you've got some weather coming your way. So, stay safe there. Folks, you don't understand. In the chat room, we actually posted comments and things to keep the conversation moving along. And Seth puts up a Doppler radar picture of a hurricane or a tornado warning in his region. So please stay safe. Sam, are you back yet? I didn't know if you were there.
Oh, yeah, I haven't been anywhere. Oh,
okay, good. Well, I'll just go ahead and ask you if there's a place that people can reach out and contact you.
Absolutely. On social media under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 in our Facebook group, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. And it looks like Kyle is confirming those tornado warnings, so we're getting all kinds of stuff in the chat box. He just put that up. So Chris and Seth, keep yourselves safe. Jamie, what about you? Where do we find you?
You can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media platforms out there. So please friend, follow, or otherwise connect with me there. And I'd love to reach out to you and have a chat with you via our Facebook group. Just search for Disaster Podcast on Facebook. Ask to join the group. We'd love to bring you in. I think we're over 600 people in the group now and continuing to grow. We post our episodes there, and you can always, almost every episode, leave a question on any given episode, and we'll connect you with the guest on that episode to answer your question, we'll answer it, Joe will answer it. We'll make sure we get somebody to get an answer and get a discussion going so that we can talk about these things like the best antibiotic that we should be carrying in the field and things like that. These are important discussions, and sometimes these things change over time as more information and research is done. But Sam, you know, this is, you know, we don't talk often about infectious disease on this show, but this is an important topic.
It certainly is, and there's so much more to discuss. You know, I've had ideas springing all over the place. So we will have to have Chris back and continue this conversation. But boy, if this is a serious example of disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.